Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Hey, this is J. Michael Michael here, and if you're like me, you love talk radio. And like me, you just can't find the right stations for your talk radio habit on the AM radio dial. Well, how about you tune in to LA Talk Radio? See, LA Talk Radio is a .com and has it all, from sports to politics to religion to, well, to just regular talk. And right now we have the beginning writer's very favorite show, The Writer's Block. So sit back, get in that rocker, grab yourself a glass of bourbon, and get comfortable, because it all starts right now.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Bob Brill, only on LA Talk Radio.
I'm going to let you guess what that
Schindler's
is.
Schindler's List.
There you go.
I drew that right off the
Very good.
Give me two notes.
I thought it was an extremely appropriate piece of music for tonight's guest.
Perfect.
Thank you, I guess.
I looked for this.
Oh.
I always do that, though. Anyway, hi, Bob.
Hey, Jim. How you doing?
We're
wrapping it up.
We are at the end of the year. Hey, this is LA Talk Radio, and you are listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, in studio with the lovely, vivacious, and effervescent Bob Brill.
It's that lovely that gets me.
I know. This is such a pretty piece of music.
Let's
do a couple more bars. Okay. Here we are, the last show of the year.
And it's a great one, too. I'm really looking forward to
this one is going to be a good one. We have in the studio tonight just a tremendous person. You know him, you love him. You've seen him on Channel 11 News and Fox, and you've seen him all over the place. And he's been in every courtroom that's got the big stuff going on.
Always defending.
Well, not always. Sometimes he's reporting. But I'm going to let him give you his bio, other than the fact that he was born and raised here in Southern California, and he is an attorney, and he's also a professor of law at Loyola. So, without any further ado, would you please welcome to the Writer's Block, Professor Stanley Goldman.
Funny, that's exactly the way it sounds whenever I enter the classroom.
Yeah, right. I've done a few Loyola law professors, and I don't ever think that was the what they ever told me they got when they entered the classroom.
I'm talking about the music, not to mention the
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, microphones are nothing new to you.
No. Well, hopefully.
Well, you may want to get a little closer to that one, but I mean.
No, I've talked in a few mics over the years.
Yeah, I mean, God, you're broadcasting for how many years?
I spent 10 years full-time with the Fox News Channel, and before that I was with CNBC, and I was CBS's legal analyst, legal correspondent on the radio, for network radio, for a couple of years. During the O.J. trial, I was 3 hours a day live on the radio.
So this is not new. But this is new. You're talking about your new little publication here.
That's true. I have a new book.
And now you have this book was not written overnight. I understand it was written over the course of a few years.
Years. That's right. I got the idea for writing the book when I was given a luncheon talk back in 2009. I turned it into an article and put it away for about a year and a half. And one January, I found myself in a completely remarkable position. That was my only class of the semester had been canceled for reasons by the school. It had been canceled for scheduling reasons and everything else, too. And I said, I think I'll take that article and turn it into a book. It was going to take me 6 months. Well, that was January 2012, and the book came out a couple weeks ago.
Uh-huh. Well, you're used to writing. You've written a lot in the law reviews, and you've had things published.
Yeah,
and,
you know, I wrote legal briefs for years. And you know, I'm one of those tenured law professors, which means you have to publish a bunch of stuff. And then I wrote it for the New York Daily News for about 2.5 years. I published about 90 stories with them.
Wow.
How did you find writing for the technical side of and the law and everything, and for classrooms and stuff, as opposed to writing this story? Because this is not only it's a true story, but also the fact that it's so personal to you.
I didn't start it out trying to write anything personal. A few years after my mother had passed away, I was in Israel visiting the woman who she'd survived the camps with. So let's not put a damper on this. This is a happy ending to the part of the story. Her daughter showed me something that kind of linked our parents to this rather unusual event in which some Jewish women had been saved near the end of the war from a camp. Mm-hmm. And I sort of started looking into it and put together a bunch of material. And eventually, when I decided to write a book, I was just going to write about the incident, which was really quite unusual. And then I sort of got persuaded by my friend to include my own story, and that's when I started to get long overdue gray hairs to my head, because it then became a very personal story.
Well, for our audience, you still don't have many gray hairs.
Yeah, that's thanks to probably my mother's side of the family or something.
Maybe we got them, but you don't.
I mean, I didn't like this since
also
I was
remember,
like 35.
I started out as a public defender. I did that for 8 years downtown.
That'll drive you.
Oh, yeah.
Defending murderers for a living, and when I gave that up to teach full-time, I think I may have saved myself a few years of life. Yeah. This is
probably
much easier.
Chronic heartburn, too.
I mean, I took a break to do the Fox News Channel for 10 years. As I say in the book, I believe the only person who will ever live who will get a monthly pension check from the L.A. County Public Defender's Office and the Fox News Channel.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
That's quite a dichotomy there.
Well, the name of his book is Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream, and the subtitle is The Bargain That Broke Adolf Hitler and Saved My Mother. You want to give a little brief synopsis of the story, and then we'll get into it a little deeper?
Well, I don't want to give it all away.
No.
But my mother was in a camp, in a death camp, and there was, I'll tell you the first line of the book. And the first line of the book is, I knew well a little Jewish woman whose life was spared by Heinrich Himmler, and the saving of her would lead to the death of Adolf Hitler. And I showed the book in its completed form to a couple of the country's leading Holocaust scholars, and when they read the book, which was nice of them to do, the first question I asked them when they were done, they said, I finished the book. I said, okay, before you say anything, have I backed up historically mm-hmm. the first sentence? Mm-hmm. And they both said, yes, you have actually backed it up. And that's all I was going to write originally, and then, as I said, I ended up interposing myself and what life was like growing up with a Holocaust survivor's mother, mm-hmm. which involves a fair amount of the book. But yeah, the book involves a very strange set of circumstances that resulted in the head of the SS, Heinrich Himmler, agreeing to free a few women from a death camp. And the book is also about some of the rather strange political consequences that one probably only act of on his part that could be seen as good. He didn't do it for a good reason. He didn't do it for a good motive. He did it to try to sort of cover his butt.
Tried to save his ass.
Delusionally thinking that some minor acts like this might help him, but in the post-war world. But it had some strange and quite unexpected political consequences.
I'm assuming you showed it to Rabbi Heyer and some...
No, I never showed it to Rabbi Heyer, but...
I was kind of curious about the reaction to those Holocaust experts that you did show it to, what their reaction was.
The reaction, because I showed it to them in not exactly the form it's in now, but in the same form, maybe a draft or two earlier, was that I hadn't intended to write something different as a structure, but apparently the structure of my book told from the point of view of, you know, myself as a child and my mother's behavior, and I intersplice through the book what happened to my mother during the war with things she did, when I was a kid growing up, her behavior towards me, and I try to match them up which was almost inadvertent. I'd never written anything long form. I mean, I talk about this is my latest book. It's also my only book. I wrote everything I've ever written is short. Even the law review articles I wrote, the scholarly stuff in these frou-frou journals, tended to be relatively short compared to what some of my colleagues wrote. I just never wrote long form. And when I started to write a book, it was so daunting, I ended up writing each, chapter and subchapter, each couple of pages as if they were like in and of themselves what I was writing. And it allowed me to mm-hmm. get through the length of a book because sure. it was made up of a lot of different, even though they were a flowing story, eventually I treated them each sort of like short couple of page columns for the daily news.
Yeah. And I've noticed that, in fact, what you just said, I noticed in your writing and in your chapters that it seemed like as you finished one certain section of a chapter, it brought up another whole section that you figured, well, I got to put that in there now. And that just kept going.
Well, when I first started it, I actually didn't think it would ever be a book because I just didn't think it would be long enough.
Uh-huh.
But what I found was every time I'd say something, and I'd go, I think I've got to include an explanation here about this or some historical point of view as to the context in which this took place or, how does my mother end up getting pulled? I mean, this is before. This is,
right.
I'm talking in the middle of the war. My mother is in line to the gas chamber at Auschwitz,
right.
And she literally gets pulled out to go to work somewhere. So I said, well, I got to find out how come she sure. gets pulled out. And that turned out to be a couple of chapters worth of material as to who made the decisions, who gave the
right.
orders, where she went to work, why she was needed there, what the work was like. So that's how then ended up being
right.
long enough for a book.
Did your
right.
mom have a skill that fit what they needed for labor that needed to be done?
Well, when my mother came to Los Angeles and sort of found herself alone, no family, no friends, didn't know anybody, didn't speak the language, I write in the book that although she didn't have anything or know anybody, she could sew.
Yeah, she was a seamstress.
And in Los Angeles, she went to work in one of those, sweatshops downtown
right.
when she came in. That's what had saved her for a while during the war. She had worked in the ghetto sewing, and she'd worked in...
Two ghettos.
She worked in two ghettos sewing, and although that wasn't the last job she had, was in a munitions factory. In the heart of Berlin, I may add, during the height of the Allied bombings, they shipped her from Auschwitz. In that case, it was from the fire into the frying pan, but,
right.
From Auschwitz, she got shipped to a place where the Allies were trying to kill them, in a sense, because
right.
they were always bombing it. But what had saved her for a long time in the war was my grandfather, who I never knew, of course, her father had been a tailor, and she had grown up as a seamstress, and she could do the tough jobs, and so she was valuable in the factories that the Germans were running. I couldn't ever quite find out whose factory she was in. For example, in one particular ghetto, I always suspected it was Hugo Boss, but I'm saying I don't know for sure, and I wasn't prepared to put that in the book because
sure.
I didn't know for sure. But she would do men's uniforms, and she was the skilled one who could put on the cuffs and the collars.
Yeah,
yeah.
That was fascinating.
And so they kept her alive.
Yeah.
I got to ask you, when you write a story or write a book that involves your own relatives, whether they're past or whether they're still alive, you learn a lot. And, of course, you kind of make those decisions what not to write for whatever reason, making them mad or, maybe they don't want to, but for whatever reason. What did you learn about your mom that you didn't know before that maybe you learned about while you're thinking back on your childhood?
Oh, wow, that's interesting. People have asked me, was writing it cathartic? And to their great disappointment, I say no, but it made me learn a lot. And I learned more about the intensity of the bombing raids she'd never really talked about. I learned more about what life was like in the ghetto. She was really not prepared to speak about any of it. What happened was when she got into her late 70s and had a stroke, but her brain was still fine, and she was still functioning, but she decided she'd finally talk about it. So she gave me about a half an hour interview that I filmed, a video, and it's available on the website on YouTube. My website, but And she divulged a lot of stuff, but it was you know, I timed it. It was like the 32nd minute. You know, we were just like scratching the surface of what I wanted to know. And she said, "Stanley," this is actually the way she talked. I'm not making this up. She said, "Stanley, have you finished now?" "Yes, Mom, we're finished now." I mean, I couldn't make her talk any longer than she wanted to. But so I was able to fill in, you know, the context of where she was and what I also found out she was a little bit of a hero, because when I went to Israel and interviewed a woman who'd been with her, the woman told me a story about how my mother saved her life. That they were being bombed, and it was pouring rain, and they were running to the bomb shelter. Now, the Jews at this factory weren't allowed to use the bomb shelter during the day because it was reserved for the German soldiers, so they literally would have to dig ditches with their hands, and they used those to hide in during the day on the factory grounds. But it was at night, so there weren't as many workers on the factory grounds, so they were allowed to go to the bomb shelter at night. So they're running to the bomb shelter, and the woman running with her takes a step, and thinking it's a puddle, it turns out it's one of these ditches that's just filled to the brim with water, and it's above her head, and she's drowning. And then she says she's drowning in the middle of this factory in Berlin, and all of a sudden she feels this terrible pain in her hand. It's my mother, who was, by the way, 4'11", and at her heaviest was about 90 pounds, pulling her out by her hair with one hand and forcing her to you know. The woman said, "I'm done. Just let me here. Get away." And yeah. My mother grabbed her and helped carry her, you know, by herself to the bomb shelter, and the bomb fell right, you know, where they've been sitting in that big pond. So, my mother had never told me the story about any of her particular heroism, but so that was to me an amazing story to hear.
Mm-hmm. Your mother had a quote that you used in the book, and I found it, actually I chuckled because it was a pretty good quote. And actually, you write your mother's accent, which is perfect.
I do. It's the one accent. I you know, when I got one editor, one publisher I sent it to, said, the, you know, he turned it down, with a very nice turn down, rejection. But he said, "You know, I have to give you some advice. You can't use your mother's accent like that. That's like demeaning." And I'm thinking to myself, what? You know, it's like this is what my mother sounded like. I mean, I don't think you can appreciate my mother unless you realize that she had talked like this. She really did have a very, very thick Yiddish accent.
Yeah.
That has long since, you know, been, you know, disappeared. Mm-hmm. But that's you can't understand her unless you hear that.
Right. Well, it's amazing because his mother has a quote, and it's. The Poles were as bad as the Germans.
Yeah.
Only the Germans were more organized.
Exactly. That was it. Whenever she hated the Poles, and I, you know, they had this law which they've now modified in Poland. They just passed a couple of years ago, which they then modified, which is you can't claim that if you're in Poland, it's a crime, or at least it was a crime, criminally punishable by, I think, 3 years in prison or something, if you tried to say that the Poles had anything to do with the Holocaust. And I remember thinking, well, am I going to be arrested if I ever set foot in Poland again? Because my mother had this one line, which it was one of the few things she not only said, she said more than once in her life. Usually the stories I heard about the Holocaust were like one time she'd say something. But she said, "The Poles was as bad as the Germans. The Germans was just better organized." And sure enough, about 2 years ago, I was going through some research, and I came across, maybe it was less than 2 years ago, this study by the U.S. State Department, dated sometime in the latter part of 1945, when there was still a question as to whether Poland would fall under the Soviets or Western influence. So they had all these studies they were doing, and one of them was about anti-Semitism. Was it going to in any way affect the country, you know, in the future? And mm-hmm. and the quote from the State Department report was, and I'm trying to get this exactly, was during the course of the war, the Poles were as bad to the Jews as were the Germans. You know, I'm thinking, like, my mother could have written this report.
Yeah. You you talk about the guy who actually met with Himmler.
Yes.
Masur,
right.
And but we also have another Swede that brought out a lot of Jewish people out of Germany, Wallenberg.
Right. He didn't bring them out of Germany. Saved them from the Germans.
Right.
Yes.
And you mentioned actually you have quite a long section in there about Wallenberg.
I did. I wasn't originally going to do it, and then I stumbled across the guy I write about who I wanted to write about because he, in many ways, saved my mother's life. He he's a Jewish furrier.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born in Germany, but when he was a teenager, he moved to Sweden. And now he's, at the time of the book taking place, the story I tell, the true story, he's 44, and he's a furrier.
Right.
Working, you know, he got a company of his own, and he, at the last minute, you know, he's done some, he's a representative of the World Jewish Congress there, and at the last minute, literally 2 hours before a plane is due to leave, they've gotten, you know, an agreement for one of their representatives to meet with Heinrich Himmler, but only in Germany. The war is still going on, mind you. So he gets on this plane with 2 hours' notice and flies to Germany. So I wanted to write about this guy because I thought it was underappreciated.
Right.
The nerve, the more than chutzpah, the nerve that it took place to get on a plane if you're a Jew and fly into a country where being a Jew is a capital offense to meet with the head of the SS. And so when I was doing some research in him, I stumbled across the fact that Raoul Wallenberg, who's an icon of the Holocaust, he's this Lutheran Swede
who
goes to Hungary and saves tens of thousands of Jews by writing passports for them, and papers, and literally, he will, as they're taking the Jews to Auschwitz, he goes to the train yards and he stands up on the trains and is instructing Jews that, you know, those people over there, they're Swedish citizens, you can't take them, and there are warning shots flying by him that the German soldiers, the guards, are shooting, and he's still doing this. And I discovered in my research that the idea for his assignment came from this guy Masser. Earlier in the war, he had written a letter to some influential people saying, look, what we need is to get somebody in Budapest, find some obviously non-Jew, some Swedish guy with you know, a background who's willing to go there and try to save a few Jews, because we think if we put somebody there, and it, of course, eventually it led to Wallenberg, who was very young and 1/16th Jewish, although I always sort of admired the fact that when people asked him, they said, are you not of Jewish ancestry? He would say, I'm half Jewish. Even though it was like 1/16th, he went back far enough in his ancestry. And he knew that. And he died. You know, he survives the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
But he gets arrested by the Soviets when they enter the country. And eventually he's killed by the Soviets, fearing that he was an American spy.
You know, one of the things I have to ask is, over the years in this country, did your mom watch many of the movies, TV shows about the Holocaust? And if she did, what was her comment to you, and how realistic and non-realistic were they?
Well, it's a short answer. The answer is no.
She I kind of figured
watch.
That.
She didn't
reason,
watch, with one exception. She and another survivor here in Los Angeles, these two women, when I was a kid, decided to go see Sidney Lumet's The Pawnbroker, starred Rod Steiger.
Wonderful movie.
Great movie. Great, great movie. I met Rod Steiger once years ago and when I was with Fox, and I told him the story, and he just said, yeah, that may be my favorite film I ever made. I talk about it in the book only because it was a real rarity. It was a depiction of a Holocaust survivor. I think the movie was made in like 1964 or something. And it was a depiction of a Holocaust survivor. Mass media, movies, they stayed away from that. If they had anybody who was a survivor, it was maybe see a serial number on an arm or something. It wasn't about their story and their life and their inability to. So we went to that, and I insisted in sitting, at the movie. I insisted in sitting not near my mother or friend. And so I, rose away. And then they came out. They came out, and they said, I heard one of them say to the other, hard to believe that we were there. You know, that was the reaction. That's the only time I'd ever known her to see such a movie or any play or anything like that.
Yeah, it was a good movie. I liked Schindler's List only because it was, like, heartwarming, I guess.
Yeah, it takes some heat from Holocaust scholars because it's one of the rare exceptions in which a large group of people were saved. But on the other hand, you know, how are you going to get an audience to go? I mean, my book is also about survival. It's it tracks a group of women who did make it through while those around them did not, and what it took to get through. And I talk about, a lot of people think it, as I did when I was young, I just assumed it was luck because my mother was this, I thought, this weak little woman. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize the the strength that sort of lay underneath. You didn't survive unless you're
incredibly
strong.
That's what you had mentioned in the, and towards the end of the book, and I was I was interested in your thought process there, because you then you said, well, when I finally did realize, and it took a psychologist to tell me that, your mother actually was a lot stronger than you gave her credit for.
Yeah, and I wouldn't listen to him. You know, I went one time, you know, and said, Mom, what are you talking about? You're crazy. I never went back. But, you know, a few more years, and I was able to finally to sort of filter through it and realize she was just really sort of iron tough. She really was.
She had to have been.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, what she went through. I mean, she was in, what, three separate camps?
She was in, that I know of, three separate camps. She actually had told me once that they had spent like a couple of days in another camp, but I couldn't find any documentation of it, and I was very careful in this book not to include anything unless I could document it, because look, her generation is almost gone. My generation of children of survivors, you know, see how much long we've got. And then you'll be just left to the deniers.
Right.
And I didn't want to, I mean, I have a one of my best friends was a screenwriter for a number of years, and he was very successful. He sold, I think, 24 screenplays when he was in Hollywood. And I gave him an early draft of the book, and he said, oh, no, you can't write this as a nonfiction. It'll never flow, it'll never this, it'll never that. You have to write it as a novel. But this would make a really good novel. That way you can play with time and you can do this and that. And I said, you know, that would defeat three-quarters of the purpose of writing it. I want it as a document. I don't want people to think I've made anything up. I want from beginning to end everything I say in the book, not to be suggested by a true story or, you know, inspired by a true story. I want it to be 100% accurate.
Part. It really is. It's an extremely tough part, because you always have to Hollywoodize it up, you know, and for dramatic influence or whatever. And maybe it plays better as a documentary, you know. It's just the story itself is just so tremendous. It's all to come through it and understand from beginning to end where it goes is just, you know, phenomenal as far as getting people to believe, you know, this really did happen. You know, because a lot of people, are, like you said, there are the deniers, but even those who do believe it happened aren't totally understanding of actually what happened, that people made it through, that not everybody died, that some people came through and lived lives here. A friend of mine, or actually my wife's friend, was a survivor and had a life here and finally won her paintings back at the Klimts. And, you know, so there's all those many, many stories. And it's great to know that you were able to transpose this one into something that'll last on the shelves forever, you know, because so many of those stories did not.
Right.
You know? Yeah, there's some. I mean, I personally believe almost everyone who went through it and survived could have a book written about them. And I think if they had a child, their child could write a book about it. The only problem is it sort of takes years to do it.
Yeah.
And you have to be, you know, I mean,
well, it takes you years just to dig the information out of the
took
parent.
It took a long time of, you know, I must have read 80 books about the period and read articles, and I went to the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, and I actually stumbled across, thanks to the help of a young German who was there on a fellowship from Germany and was a Holocaust scholar, I managed to find some testimonials written by five women who were in my mother's group that the Holocaust Museum there in Jerusalem called Yad Vashem had taken from them back in the 90s. So I you know, and they're not online. You know, I actually find it in Hebrew, and I had to get somebody to translate it for me. And I got not so much new material, but I got some confirmation from others as to what had happened with this group. You know, where they were, what had happened to them, you know, where they'd been. So it took a lot of time.
Well, you know, that generation too, you have two problems. Number one, you have the problem of maybe they don't want to talk about it. Maybe they do. But the other problem is, and I found this out when I interviewed my father, I sat down with my mom and dad for a couple of hours just with the tape recorder back in the 80s. And they didn't think the wonderful stories that I got out of them weren't anything. I was like, yeah, well, we just lived that. You know, that's what it was. Yeah, it's like when I would say to my mom, she would have antiques. She goes, it's just that old stuff we grew up with. I don't want that. You know, it's like, yeah, but it's a really valuable antique now that people are willing to pay thousands of dollars for. it's that old stuff. I don't want it, you know. So they didn't realize, at least in my experience, that they didn't realize that the stories that they had were really interesting stories that people coming in later on would love to hear.
You know, that I mentioned earlier that I went to Israel, and the daughter of the woman who'd been my mother's best friend and had survived the war with her, she had come across this, you know, this pamphlet written by this guy named Masser, who it was his report to the World Jewish Congress, maybe 15 pages long, about his meeting with Himmler and what he'd arranged. And she said, you know, this the timing here sounds a little like what our mothers described as to how they got out. Now, they never knew anything about this, you know. So I'm thumbing through the pamphlet, and there's at one point in the pamphlet, there's a grainy photograph taken out of a newspaper of a picture of these women who'd arrived in Sweden as part of this thing in this book about this. And I'm looking at it, and in the far left-hand corner, you know, my eyes were pretty good back then. I see in these tiny, tiny faces, I see what looks like my mother and her friend, the mother of the woman I'm sitting with. And I show it to her, and I say, look at these two women back here. And she says, she just looks at me and goes, well, you think? I can't tell. I said, yeah, I think that's them. So we go to her mother, who's still alive, and I open it up, and I show it to her, you know, with a magnifying glass, you know, big thing. And I say, could you look at this for a second? And her response was, I'll never forget, her response was, yeah, that's your mother and me. What about it?
Exactly. I like it.
I like exactly. It. We're gonna, you know, they know, it's no big deal.
Yeah, no big deal. We're going to take a little bit of a break here, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. And we are back in the studio with Professor Stanley Goldman and his book, Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream, The Bargain That Broke Adolf Hitler and Saved My Mother. And if you want to call and talk to Professor Stanley Goldman tonight, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929.
You know, I almost hate to be called professor because people are going to think the book is some stodgy, scholarly thing.
It's anything but that.
I tried to write it like I wrote my columns for the New York Daily News, to tell you the truth. I tried to do it in the same sort of vein and tone so everybody could understand it and it would flow.
The truth is this book is anything but stodgy. Nice. It's very well written, and it's got you bring up a story that most of the people have never heard about before, and that would be Masser meeting with Himmler, yeah, and arranging to have all these women released. There's like 1,000 or something.
Yeah, it was 1,000.
Yeah, and go to Sweden.
I found people who'd written about it in English. I don't read Swedish. I don't read German. For all I know, there might be something else out there. But in terms of what's been translated, the only things I ever found were like maybe a page.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what I was lucky about was that there were some other Nazis, some SS, who were present at the meeting, and including Himmler's astrologer, his masseur. He kept this masseur around because he had these stomach problems, and his masseur would rub him, and he'd be fine. And the head of his SS, intelligence service. And those three guys each lived long enough to write memoirs. And each of them not only wrote about, obviously, because they were Himmler, that was the bulk of their memoir, but they'd each have like a page or page and a half on this meeting that they attended. And they didn't really overlap. They were sort of like Rashomon. They were different versions of the same meeting. So sure. I took them all. But the historians that I wrote, you know, they'd be a page on this or something. The most I ever saw was about 4.5 pages in one book that came out in January, a translation from a Swedish book. And that book is $145, by the way. Mine's a lot less. But it had like four.
Well, thank God for that.
Thank God for that. A lot less. And that was the most I'd ever seen written about this. It's like this little event that I think, I mean, I actually say in the book, I mean, is it because so many people died that 1,000 wasn't like that big a deal? Is that what they think? So I really just wanted to, I felt a real need to tell the story.
Yeah, I just don't think people put it in perspective. They just, I mean, that figure is a lot of people.
Yeah, and they were killing people in the camp, my mother was in. This is not a place where they were just sitting around waiting to be, you know, rescued by the Russians or the Americans. Right. I mean, there was a working gas chamber in the camp they were in that hadn't been there for long, but after Auschwitz had closed, they built a gas chamber in this camp, and they had these trucks where they could gas people, and they were killing Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taken out of this camp.
But that's when she was working for Krupp?
No, that was after she was working for Krupp. She worked for Krupp in Berlin, and Krupp, as the war was ending, there were orders to take the Jews who were working for them and get rid of them, so they took them to this camp, and that's where they were when they got rescued.
One of the things I think that I see we run into, at least starting back in the 80s and 90s, and I remember a young man who had seen several movies about the Holocaust, and he'd been through things at school, and was just, you know, it was like, to him, he was tired of it. You know, it's like, oh, okay, they're beating us over the head with it. You know, and as we get further away, you know, we see more, I think we see more of that in a younger generation. And places like the Holocaust Museum, and I know Rabbi Heyer and Rabbi Abraham, both saying, you know, no, we cannot forget this. This is one of those things we got to keep alive. Are you seeing the same thing among young people as maybe that's part of the problem that we are experiencing here?
I think that it's not taught the way it was for a period of time. It tends to be lost, and I have great misgivings about this for a couple of reasons. One, the very fact of the event is so cataclysmic a part of history that I'm distraught by the fact that it's not being retold, and that I don't want to be depressing about this, but I must say one of the things I came away from reading about it so much and thinking about it so much was, I won't describe it as a pessimism, but an understanding that it will be not centuries, but millennium or epoch before the human race evolves to the point where we're no longer capable of this, because this is not the horrors of, I mean, some people look at the slave trade back in the 1700s and they say, oh, well, those people back then, they weren't civilized like we are today, or the destruction of indigenous populations, you know, by colonialists. Like, oh, that was, you know, we're long past that. Well, this was Germany. This was the most sophisticated, advanced country in the world that does this, you know, that's why I wanted, in some respects, I like putting in my own voice to show the connection. That this is not that far, this is not ancient history. This is people like we are today.
Mm-hmm.
And the main reason why I point that out is not that I'm pessimistic for the human race. It's just I firmly believe that we must, because nothing's going to change in us in terms of our Darwinian ancestry for a long, long time, that we have to be forever vigilant not to let this sort of thing fester again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we have to, those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. I think if you don't know what led in the 20s and the 30s to the creation of fascism and the Nazis and all radical totalitarian or authoritarian groups, you know, because you're afraid to, because it's too extreme an analogy, you may tend to risk not intervening when you should have.
And at the moment, I mean, we have things like Darfur, we have ethnic cleansing, we have what happened in the Balkans in the 90s. You know, it was, which all goes back to the Ottoman Empire. But, you know, so we do have that today. And that's the scary part. I mean, I think of the Holocaust as, okay, it's happening now. we still have that. I mean, not as concentrated as we had with a system where, you know, it was designed to do and kill as many of Jews and gypsies as it was designed to do in such a, what's the word, mechanical way, you know, where we have places, things like in Darfur and, well, like I mentioned, in the Balkans, where it's done differently, but it's still ethnic cleansing.
Look, I started a few years back, I raised money from, by the way, almost exclusively Armenian former students of mine of Armenian ancestry, called the Center for the Study of Law and Genocide. And we do several things there, put on programs. I also sponsor young graduates from the law school to go to international tribunals around the world and clerk. So we pay their salaries and we do some work for international tribunals around the world, writing them points and authority memorandum. But part of this, at some of the symposium I've had a young woman who's a Rwandan survivor. She was a child survivor of the genocide, of the slaughter. She comes in, and when she speaks, you know, if I close my eyes and didn't hear her accent, I would think she was a Holocaust survivor talking about what it was like. And it's very eerie to hear a young voice describing something that occurred to her. That's the sort of thing you think of from being old folks and a different era. And this is ancient history, and it's still around us. It could take place anywhere, anytime, someplace. Maybe even as mechanized and, as my mother would have said, as well-organized as it did with the Germans. It's just there's something in our makeup that can hate the other enough to sometimes, in the worst of circumstances, lead to just these mass atrocities.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. And I see stuff getting closer and closer these days, and it's scary. You know, it just really is scary. But we are who we are.
I write about Himmler in the book because he's an essential figure in the book, and I write about what made Himmler and the Nazis feel, you know, their philosophy about what they felt about the Jews. And I got to tell you, it seems like it is absolutely identical to what the mass murderer in Pittsburgh felt when he went into that synagogue.
Right.
I mean, it's exactly what he seemed to believe. You know, right. The Jews were, you know, financially responsible for all this and these ills and that. But I mean, it's one person. But you could have put him in Nazi Germany, you know, and give him a German accent and let him talk there, and we would have sounded exactly the same.
Well, it's that, and it's the right wingers that, you know, stomp around in their Nazi clothing and their flags,
and how much
I don't know,
and so much of it gets the term that I really abhor is the international banking cartel.
Well,
always, yeah. Traced back to, you know, those who want to destroy the Jews.
Kind of a morose ending, yeah, to a great, yeah, show.
I could tell a few Jewish mother jokes before we go off the air. If that would help.
Why don't you end on one? There we go.
Well, we're gonna we're gonna wrap this up with you, Stan, and I just want to thank you for, we usually ask you questions about like other stuff, and this is so fascinating. I didn't want to, you know, it's just, you're a fascinating guy to talk to. And I want to thank you so much for taking your time and the drive up the road.
Well, thanks. Us. As I said, the book just came out, so this is my first media interview. So,
well, we're honored. This is fairly new. This came out October, right?
No. This came out on the 8th of December.
Oh, it's brand new.
You just kind of
broke the back there.
Yeah, we did. And it's left to the mercy of a rude stream, the bargain that broke Adolf Hitler and saved my mother. It's by Stanley A. Goldman, Loyola law professor, and Fox News guy, and all around nice guy.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a Jew teaching at a Jesuit law school and a Kennedy liberal working for the Fox News Channel. I've lived a rather circumspect life.
I like that. I like the liberal working for the Fox News Channel. Anybody that can get a dig in over there, God bless you. Thanks for coming in and visiting, sure, with us, Stan. Don't go away. And, of course, this is our last. Show of the year.
Oh, okay.
And I want to take the time out to thank.
I thought you were going to sing All the Anxiety.
To thank all of the guests that have come in this year, 50 of them. And we welcomed Bob Brill to our stable of personalities, and I was really thankful that he opted to come in and join us.
Thank you.
Well, sure.
It's been a pleasure.
I'll tell you what, you bring a whole different thing to the show. I don't know what it is, but
I'm not sure what a thing is. But.
And of course, we lost Bobby Jean this month, but of course she'll be back in January.
More wine, more chocolate.
She's probably sitting there listening right now. Our other co-host is Bobby Jean Bell, and she lives in Albuquerque now. She used to be sitting right in that chair. So I want to thank, again, all of the guests that have come in and all of the publicists that have brought guests in to us. And I especially want to have a big thank you for my wife, Jerry, that is the producer and booker for the show. Her nickname is The Bookie. And you actually sent her some emails. And your emails came from... speaking to you now, Stan.
Yes.
Your emails came from Brian Costello.
He runs public relations
and,
at the law school.
Melissa Abraham.
Yes, they do, at the school.
And, they're very cordial.
Nice people.
Apparently.
Even in spite of being lawyers. Yeah.
Don't get me started on lawyers.
I'm very fond of lawyers. I spent my life training them.
Bob, you have anything you want to, any bits of stuff you want to give out?
Boy, no, actually. It has been a really cool year. It's been a real pleasure. I'm looking forward to 2019.
Yeah, me too.
And for all the authors that we're going to be talking to, and it's been fun. It's just been it's been a hoot. Let's put it that way.
It's yeah. Different.
And I'm kind of looking forward to coming back at some point because I start Lancer next month, the next Lancer book.
I thought you already started Lancer.
No, I start writing in January. I just finished the screenplay I was writing this week. I wanted to get that out of the way, the first draft, and send it off to a couple of friends of mine to look at it. I don't want to give the title out because I'm tossed between two. But
I would rather not see it until it's in book form.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Any special things you're doing for the holidays besides
working? Believe it or not,
ducking bill collectors.
No, actually, that's been pretty good lately. I've been it's funny. I've been working at local radio station a lot lately, and I'm working Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and I do a lot of overnights and weekends and stuff. So it's been kind of hectic, I got all my Christmas shopping done 2 weeks ahead of time though.
So good for you.
All stuff off to my daughter and grandkids in Texas.
Oh, cool.
They're all enjoying all the food that I sent them. So,
well,
it's
always,
all Italians.
All the kids are
all about food.
Are gone. We're empty nesters. So Jerry's having a little bit of a hard time this year, and I don't blame him. I am too, actually. I loved having the kids over at Christmas time, and not this year. There just isn't any around.
And I've still got to have the burgers.
That's right.
I haven't gone there yet.
Well, you know what? I half expected a bottle of almond tequila tonight, but hey.
Interesting. I'll tell you about that a little later.
Bob, they go to Mexico and they smuggle in almond tequila.
I've never heard of it.
Oh my God. Really? It is so good. We sat here one night and was drinking shots on the air. It was fun.
I was wondering why you guys were behaving the way you were. You seemed to have been sober. I didn't know it was in those water bottles, though.
No. That was months ago, but...
There's a factory in Puerto Vallarta that makes wonderful almond-flavored tequila, and it's just really, really good. We just cracked it. We just cracked the last bottle. My wife went down on a cruise and said, they delivered a case to the ship so we could bring it back because they won't ship it.
I've been looking for a substitute for the soy milk I use on my cereal.
This will work.
Almond tequila.
Yeah. Almond flavor.
In fact, I'll stay in touch because a friend of mine who owns a tequila company here, we've been trying to get him to import it. And I put the two sides together, and they're trying to work out a deal. And so hopefully that may work out where we can get some that way.
That'd be fun, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that stuff is good. I mean, the bookie sat here and was taking shots.
Yeah, she kept asking for more.
So anyway, yeah. So I mean, this has been a great year. I mean, we're working on our fourth year now in the air, and it's been a good ride. It's been a fun ride.
It's been fun.
And we have great guests like you coming up. This is, I believe, only the second book that we've ever had that's nonfiction.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm honored.
most everyone is a fiction
writer.
Yeah.
Well, I tried to get it to read like a fiction, even though I want everybody to accept the fact it's not.
Oh, it totally does. It totally does. It's really, really a good story. And I'm amazed at the twists and turns that everything took.
Stranger than fiction.
Truth usually is.
I have a line in the book in which I say that fiction is, in order for fiction to be believed, there must be at least some plausibility to it. But truth is not so circumscribed.
Exactly. And with that being said, Stanley, again, thank you for joining us. It's been a hoot having you. Bob, Merry Christmas.
You too, Jim.
And you have a wonderful holiday, Stan. And you're going out to dinner or going to your friend's house for a Christmas dinner.
I am.
Ah, is it a goose? I didn't mean to get personal.
Might be a turducken.
I was going to say, turducken is probably the way to go.
And for Bobby Jean Bell, myself, Jim Christina, Bob Bell, and what's his name again? Russ Avison.
There you go.
Who is here occasionally, whenever. Thank you so much for putting up with us during the year. We are booked through June.
And Henry.
And Henry Park. Yeah. And we are booked through June. And let's start this whole thing again in January 3rd. We are out of here.